You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM and WSLR.org on the internet. This is the Peace and Justice Report. My name is Bob Connors. Tom Walker is here. And Alvaro is in the control on the control board to make sure you hear everything we say today. Can we be heard, Alvaro? We got a thumbs up. We finally found out Alvaro's name is pronounced Alvaro. It only, only took 2.5 years. He never told us.
Yeah. But it varies. It certainly varied with us. But now it's Alvaro.
It's Alvaro now. Yeah.
So, Alvaro's a great volunteer up in Tampa at WMNF as well.
He graduated from WMNF to WSLR. He had to put in 16 years there so he could qualify to meet our high qualifications for WSLR. So thank you, Alvaro. And Tom, I know you have a great guest lined up. She hasn't come in yet. So
right. She's coming in via Zoom. She hasn't come in yet, but we won't worry about it. You know, there was a great show at WSLR Live show at Fogartyville last night about the news, about how people gather the news. We had some reporters for the networks. We had Billy Cox, who used to write.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember Billy. He was on the show a couple of times. Yeah.
Great guy. We had Carrie Seedman, who writes a weekly column in the paper.
She was on the show once, I know.
At least once, maybe twice. Yeah.
We ought to have a round table right here on Peace and Justice Report. With them, you know.
Oh.
I'm sure a lot of people didn't get to attend last night. So maybe sometime a month or so from now, we can have
them
on the show.
I had wonderful, great things to say about how they create the news, how they edit it, how they interview, what it takes to get to know a person while you're interviewing them. Billy said one thing he does is when they go to the bathroom, he's at their house. When they go to the bathroom, he looks at all their books and yeah. Find what they're reading.
That's
right?
Great. That's great.
And then he asks them about some of the books. So that's one way. They also told some stories about some interviews that later turned out in a tragic way. Somebody accused them of being misinterpreting or misstating their interview, and then one of them committed suicide. And interview people in depth, I guess you can. We interview famous people or newsmakers, but when you interview individual citizens, you got to be careful what you say. There was one story about interviewing a fellow who started an escort service, and the guy said it's not for sex, it's for real escorts to real people who need a companion at a ball or function. And it's great. He wrote the story, and then later the guy called up and said, "Oh, hey, ruined me, and ruined my reputation." Evidently, people had just assumed the worst, and the guy committed suicide 2 days later. It's live. We don't have that kind of guess. You know, our guests are used to the public world, but newspapers and in-depth interviews. What a career! I remember the first newsman I talked to was a UPI guy a long time ago, and he said, "Reporting is a great, great profession." You said you get paid to be nosy.
that's great. That's great.
And Bob, and you and I are kind of the same thing. We get to ask questions of people who know a lot,
even in real life outside the Peace and Justice Report, when I meet somebody, I don't have any interest in talking about myself. I always want to find out about them. I mean, this is before I even got on the show, because I just find it more interesting than, I will talk about myself if they ask me about myself, but invariably, many people are so happy talking about themselves that they'll go on for a half hour. You ask them three questions, and they haven't even noticed that you're sitting across the room. They're just so involved in what they're talking about. So I find that interesting. And some of the people I meet like that, I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to hang out with this person because they're so wrapped up in themselves. They might be a good guest for a radio show.
Right.
But as far as wanting to be friends with people who are so wrapped up in themselves, all they do is talk about themselves and they never ask you a question.
Yeah, yep, that's true. I enjoy people who ask me questions naturally because, you know, I get to talk about myself. But I have the nicest friends are always got another question. And I'm trying to teach myself to do that. Always ask another question about to the person you're talking to. Oh, I think our guest just chimed in.
Well, let me say before she comes on that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station.
So with that, let me introduce our first guest today is Rachel Bitticoffer. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Rachel is a political scientist and strategist who came to prominence after predicting the size to the seat of the Democrats' rare blue wave in the 2018 midterms. Her new book, Hit 'em Where It Hurts, How to Save Democracy by Beating Republicans at Their Own Game, takes a look at the Republicans' own playbook, sharing how Democrats can turn the right's own tactics against them. That's what we're going to be talking about. Rachel graduated from the University of Oregon with a bachelor's degree in political science in 2009. She earned a PhD in political science and international affairs in 2015. Began working as an instructor at the University of Georgia in 2012. Christopher Newport University. And then she's now a political scientist and election forecaster turned political strategist. Her interviews and analyses have been featured on the New York Times, Washington Post, Salon, Politico, New Republic, Real Time with Bill Maher, CNN, MSNBC, and many other prominent news sources. And she worked with the Democratic Party candidates to implement negative partisanship strategy in the 2022 midterms. Congratulations on. Now, let me say, I just finished your book, the whole book, yesterday. I couldn't put it down. It's amazing. Thank you for sending it. And I loved it. I'm recommending it to everybody I see, especially all my people involved in politics. The first question would be about the book. Why is Republican messaging so much more effective than ours in some cases? What do they do right that we do wrong?
You're implying you're a Democrat, Tom. You're giving yourself away.
I am a Democrat.
That's why I said the opinions you hear are strictly those of the host and the guests. And don't.
I hope people figure that out.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Rachel. I had to point that out.
Okay, go ahead, Rachel.
Okay. Yeah, no, so the entire front part of the book is about explaining the soil our electioneering system is the plant, the tree, the entire thing is planted in bad assumptions, okay? Because the reason the Republican system works so well, which you just asked, is that it's designed to meet the electorate where it is. And unfortunately, the electorate is not like the fine folks listening to us right now, highly engaged, highly informed, paying attention to all the details and intrigues, especially of this current, you know, political peril that we face. That would be wonderful. In fact, if our voting electorate was like that, we actually wouldn't be on the precipice of collapsing into fascism. But the electorate is not like that. It has never been like that. And when political science first emerged as a field, behavioral political science sought to answer a question. I mean, we had something called surveys. We could actually find out things about the electorate. So the first thing they endeavored to learn about American voters is like, what do they know? And they found out even back, and this is back in the 50s when people still kind of did read the news and watch newspaper or read newspapers, they found out Americans don't know anything. That actually they almost don't know anything except for the president's name, right? And the political scientists argue in the book, but don't worry, because you don't really need to know anything about particular people, because you have this thing called the party label that you can use as a cognitive shortcut. And it will tell us, like, sorts the candidates for people, and it allows them to make what the authors argued were smart decisions based on this heuristic, this cognitive shortcut. Well, that's always been the case, though you've never really seen our election analyst talking about how important, I mean, powerful predictor of vote choice, even for most independents, because most independents will admit that they lean one way or the other. And when they do, you look at their voter behavior, it's almost the same as people who are admitted partisans. So when you think about how powerful partisanship is, I don't need to know anything about you. You could be a black dot on the screen. I don't know if you're a man, a woman, old, young, college educated, urban, rural, suburban, doesn't matter. I don't know anything, but I know that you are either a Democrat or a Republican, or you are an independent who admits to leaning to one of the two parties. I can predict your vote choice a year out from an election, basically. 9 out of 10 times, I'll be right, because that's how strong partisanship is. So when you ask me what's wrong, it's because our system has ignored the importance of that brand, right? You have to ride for the brand. You will live or die on whether the voters, especially the swing voters, have a good, like, top of mind of awareness of your party brand. And that's why Democrats have lost so many really close elections with good candidates, because at the end of the day, those candidates are running an old strategy that disassociates from the brand. It affirms the Republican attacks that there's something wrong with being a Democrat, and it's very, very dangerous. So that's why this book is such a paradigm shift in terms of electioneering strategy.
Yeah, you say we're playing checkers, they're playing chess. Two different, which of course sounds like a losing proposition. And you say democracy is at stake this election, and I totally agree. Talk about some of their tactics, the at-a-glance rule and message at-a-glance, and talk about some of the strategies we could use instead of what we do.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things that we do, right? So based on what I was just telling you about the electorate not knowing anything, Republicans understand that. And so, like, when you think about their stuff, it is designed to frame a public perception about us, right? You know, something like Democrats love open borders, right? What does that do, right? It creates an image in the voter's mind. It's hyperbolic because, you know, nobody wants an open border. And it's not accurate, right? But it creates like a hyperbolic association, right? We don't do stuff like that. Like, think about this. If I go into a room and I ask Republicans, who wants to take away your guns? They're going to say, Democrats. Now, if I go into a room full of progressive activists, okay, and I'm like, why don't we have any climate change legislation? They're like, oh, you know, big oil, this, Congress, that, da 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 da. I'm like, dude, because the Republicans are blocking it, right? We don't tell people that. Like, they don't. The Republicans, the reason their obstruction stuff has worked so well is that we think everyone knows because it was on the nightly news, dude. Nobody knows. We have to tell them. And so it's really about getting people to understand, you have to tell the electorate the most horrible things because they don't automatically know them. And it's all true. We don't even have to make things up like they do. We just have to tell people what Republicans are actually up to, right? And then we have to get it across in a way. So instead of saying, you know, Republicans are going to cut sunset Social Security and da 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 da, just tell people Republicans are going to steal your Social Security.
Right? Coming for you. They're coming for your Social Security, right? Right.
Yeah.
I liked a couple of phrases from your book. For instance, today's Republican Party is a threat to your freedom, health, wealth, and safety. And that's four things we can emphasize right there. And
you right, and all under one branding frame, Republicans.
One sentence. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So like the reefer, because you know how they do that, right? They do that to us. So it might be about immigration, or it could be crime, or it could be whatever, right? But it's always the same theme. Democrats are a threat to you, voter.
And now we want to say they're threat. Elaborate a little bit on that. You say, in fact, and I agree, they're a threat to our freedoms, freedom to read, freedom to choose, and so forth. We should emphasize that threat.
Oh, yes, definitely. We've allowed Republicans to own the mantle of freedom and liberty for some reason. They're very specific about the freedom and liberty they advocate for, right? I mean, it's more freedom from than freedom to, right? What are they asking the government to do? To protect them from our freedom. They don't want to have to be, to even see gay people kissing, or, you know, women having to get an abortion or whatever it is, right? They want to be protected from that. So, you know, it's a mistake. It was always a mistake. I mean, I have no idea where the frame of pro-choice came from. I have no idea who invented that. I have no idea who invented trust women, right? But I do know that with pro-choice, like, you have set yourself up to lose, because if you're asking somebody what's more important, pro-choice or a life, right? It makes you sound like you're going to a drive-thru. So redefining abortion as freedom, as individual liberty and bodily autonomy, is so important. What has really flipped the morality of the abortion issue around is that, you know, they caught the car. The dog caught the car. They caught it before they seized permanent power. So that is to say, they've caught the car while there's still time for us to do something about it, right? And, right. The second that happened, I started talking about, I'm a person that studies fundamentals for elections, and that's what I use to predict stuff. So moving a fundamental is very difficult in an election, but I knew Dobbs was going to do it, because the minute that Supreme Court leaked or went into effect, a lot of these red states reverted to very, very barbaric abortion regimes, right? And I knew at that point it was going to become about women. Like, women were going to run into this machine and suffer. When they did, some of them were going to eventually find out what happened to them, because a lot of them would have no idea why they can't get an abortion, why they're being told they have to carry a baby to sepsis until it's happening to them. And that's the first time they're ever hearing, folks, oh, the Republican Party did this to me and passed a law. Like, they don't know that, because in our world, we know everything, but they don't pay attention. They're watching Beyonce and NFL and other things, right? So a lot of these women don't even know their rights. They're at the mercy of these Republican death panels until they show up and they're in one, right?
Yeah.
And I knew that was going to change it, because, like, the morality had always favored hypothetical babies, right? It's always a baby that would have had a great life if only a selfish mother hadn't murdered it. And it's, you know what I mean? So once the hypothetical, you know, kind of gets dwarfed by the reality of suffering women, because, you know, it's, these laws go into effect immediately, it was always going to be the case that it was not going to favor them as much. But getting off of this idea of choice is very important, I think, in terms of abortion rhetoric.
Reframe it in terms of freedom. Personal freedom.
And big government.
Say that again?
And big government. I mean, Republicans have basically spent 40 years branding limited government, right? Like, so if you ask people in polls, there's a big difference between what they like in policy, what we call operational ideology, and symbolic ideology. Things like government should be small, limited government, deregulation, right? We love those words, especially because Republican propaganda has been pounding love of them, you know, nonstop since 1980 into the head of the American mind. But we don't necessarily associate them, you know, to the parties, right? So, like, if they've primed the pump and now we can tell people these are big gov Republicans, you don't want the Republican Party in your bedroom, right? Right. And that you know, it's going to benefit us, so...
So there are two things I want to talk about. Your advice: pivot, ridicule, and attack. We don't do enough of that. Explain an example of how we might do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing is to understand the purpose, right? So like when our talking heads show up to go on Meet the Press or whatever, they have not traditionally shown up to achieve public opinion framing. They have showed up because they want to have a substantive conversation about wonky policy specifics, right? And in the other side of the glass table, right, if you're like on Face the Nation or whatever, you get someone like Chris Christie. Chris Christie is there for one thing and one thing only, to frame public opinion, okay? So there's not a conversation that Chris Christie's having on substance. He's making political points. Yes. And winning the narrative, right? So that part of that is detraining us, because they know that about us. And I lay out in the book, if you read the book, then you know I lay out very much in detail how they served us up CRT in Virginia in 2021. Oh. and knew the strategy would work because of our predictability, right? Our predictable responses were, what do you mean? This is something that's taught in law school. There's no schools teaching CRT, right? All defensive. And all we did was legitimate. Like, we spent a month. I mean, every station, I monitor media, all the Democrats, all of them having these substantive, wonky, long-term, you know, let's bring this scholar on. And all it did was help make CRT the number one, a thing that no one had heard of 9 months previous, became the central theme. Right. And that just really goes to show how powerful public opinion framing can be. If you have the machine and you know how to manipulate our media, too, you can take something that I, who have known almost everything in politics, had never even heard of prior to like early 2021, and then make it the central theme of a campaign. So, you know, they understand our behavior. They know we can't. We know that we love to be right. Right. And we are right. And like, so if they lay the trap for us, we will walk into it every single time. So getting people to not do that is pretty important. And then an example is this, right? So say I'm on that Sunday talk show and, you know, whatever, it's Ron DeSantis. He says something about wanting to protect kids, right? Because that's his whole thing. They're going to protect kids. And really what they mean when they say that is from us, genitalia mutilating Democrats. Okay, that's right. How hyperbolic their rhetoric is.
Right.
But if any Republican ever makes a mistake of saying the words "protect kids near me," they're going to get it, because I'm going to be pivoting and attacking really quick. Protect kids. Oh, I'm so glad, Governor DeSantis, you want to talk about protecting children, because I want to understand why you're letting our children get, you know, slaughtered at school with weapons of war. Why do you want dead kids, DeSantis? Because that's what they would do to us, right? Like, they would say that on abortion. Then they like, why do you want to murder babies? And then what would we do? Be like, I don't want to murder babies. This is what I mean. Right. So you're basically pushing them into that defensive posture by making an outlandish, belittling claim and then attacking them on the issue. And what we're doing basically is framing opinion, right? So whatever his response is, the person on the recipient end of that programming is going to hear, oh, Ron DeSantis, killers, you know, right, you know, wants weapons of war in school. Right.
Right. Right. What's another thing you talk about, wedge issues or wedgies. What, how does that work exactly? How can we use that?
Yeah. So you can run on policy or you can wedge a policy issue. Republicans wedge a policy issue. So what they do is they take something that people have a lot of passion about, like guns.
Yeah.
Okay. And what they do is they make it intentionally partisan and hyperbolic, so they don't get caught up in the details. What is the Republican argument about us and guns? We're going to take away all of your guns.
Right.
Doesn't matter if you actually are Joe Manchin or if you're Andrea Ocasio-Cortez, you're getting the same broad brush person that's going to steal all your guns, right? And so, you know, take Social Security for example. Like, there, it's a policy. You can run on the policy, or you can wedge the policy because it's something that people care a lot about, and you can tell them it's under threat and that Republicans are coming to take it away from them. That takes that emotion and need of that policy and rechannels it into opposition for Republicans.
Yeah, and we should keep the, in your book, you said keep things simple and use a ridicule, of course, like the clown car of a Republican Congress. And we should imitate their simplicity, their repetition. As you point out, it was in Mein Kampf that Hitler said we must use stereotype formulas and be persistently repeated. So they certainly do that. What is the at a glance test? I know what it is, but I thought that was funny. Yes. About the mailers you get in the mail.
Yeah, I mean, so one, you know, there's a lot of asymmetries in the products that Democrats and Republicans have tended to produce. And keep in mind, a lot of this stuff is being reformed, right? But one of the things that Republicans do really well is they understand that voters aren't like dying to read your junk mail, okay? Like, think about how you feel. Like, you go get to the mailbox, right? You take out your mail, and you got like, you know, mail, and then you've got like a roofer. A direct mailer, a glossy thing from the local roofing company, or maybe it's the car dealership with like, you know, oil deals or whatever it is, right? And you take one glance at it and you're like, oh, that's, you know, junk mail, and then you toss it. That's pretty much what your political advertising is going to get to your target, because people like us want to read it, but no one else, okay? Right. And that's your target audience is basically no one else, right? So if what Republicans figured out long ago is like, look, you get the glance. If that's the time that you get, then you have to make sure the main theme is conveyed in a glance. So it's about putting, you know, the Democratic rep with Obama and Pelosi's faces, or now Joe Biden and the squad and whoever the candidate is, and, you know, some kind of big, bold, you know, headline, they're coming for you, or Democrats are socialist, or whatever it is, right? The socialist threat, right? Because at the end of the day, like, the message is already delivered, right? As soon as I glance at it, I see Biden's face with Pelosi and, you know, whatever else. I see that message. I can't not see it. You know what I mean? And yeah. So, like, we got to stop assuming that people are dying to read. I mean, you should see the angst that people put into these direct mailers. Should we say this? Should we say that? And there's little fine print everywhere. And it's, yeah, I'm like, look, dude, no one's going to read that. Okay?
That's right. Like, I made little business cards with that 15 points that Bernie Sanders made back when he was running for president. Nobody's going to read all those little points except people who already care about that.
That's exactly right. And the people who make it, right? So, like, a lot of our problem is we've been making content for liberals by liberals, and right. What we need to be making is content for everyone by liberals.
Right. And right, and everyone, of course, over half of the United States adults cannot name the three branches of Congress, and
right,
over half of the adults eligible to vote do not vote. I mean, we've got a pretty amazingly lackluster populace here. We've got to educate.
We have an absolutely anemic civic culture, and I talk about how we've built that thing on purpose. Basically, we've literally cultured, at least since my last few generations, people to not care about, to not understand or see or even know there's a relationship between rights and responsibilities. Right, the rights part. I mean, many people can't tell you what is in the First Amendment. They might be able to pick one thing, like freedom of speech or something, right? But, like, we get the rights in practice anyway, even if we don't really understand how they're articulated. But the responsibility stuff, we're, like, literally culturing people not – and I talk about how people will feel embarrassed about skipping a workout, but if they but they're proud – that they don't vote, right? What? They're not ashamed, right? I mean, I meet people all the time, and when I'm like, oh, yeah, I work in politics, they're like, oh, yeah, I don't do any of that stuff. And they're not like, oh, I don't do any of that stuff, I know, I feel so bad. It's like, oh, I don't do any of that stuff, right? Like, I'm not dirty like that, right? And so, you know, a lot of it is... you know, this is the work that if we can save democracy, we've got to get serious about. We got to find a way to interrupt that and change that, because we are culturing people to be dumb, and that dumbness is highly exploitable by foreign entities like Iran and Russia, end to, you know, Nazis in America.
My friends who knew I was going to be talking to you asked several questions. One of them, in fact, was how do we best motivate infrequent Democratic voters to vote? How do we get people more interested in actually registering and voting? That's a good question. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I think the way to do it is to tell them their rights and freedoms are under threat.
The line.
Not other people's, not out groups, not nameless brown people, them. Okay. Like we want to make all of our messaging is about collectivism, but the truth is all humans are on a bell curve of self-interest. Okay. And even liberals are still humans psychologically. We may be out on one of these curve on the tails in terms of like caring about out groups and other people. Like, you know what I mean? But we're still on the bell curve. It's like people are motivated for themselves or their own family or their own things much better than for other people. So I think that's the secret to cracking that nut. Most of those people have no idea democracy is on the verge of collapse. Tell them how it's going to affect them personally, and tell them the only way to save themselves is to vote D for democracy in 2024.
That same person asked, how do you combat MAGA by campaigning against MAGA candidates for local office, or devote your resources to big targets like president and the Senate? And I think your answer in your book was paint them all with the same brush. No matter
yes.
local or national.
No quarter. Right. They didn't give Joe Biden any quarter, or Jamie Harrison when he ran down in South Carolina. They painted him as somebody wanted to defund the police. He's a socialist, right? What we have allowed ourselves to do is be like, well, if David Schweikart is a moderate, we can't like attack that brand, right? And what I'm basically telling people in swing races is paint your Republican opponent as an extremist, right? Well, that's what it really comes down to. Because if you want people to know J.D. Vance is an extremist, you're going to have to tell them, we know he's an extremist. The Ohio electorate never once heard that about J.D. Vance. All they heard was Tim Ryan's bipartisan. He's going to get stuff done. He's not one of those Democrats, right? And if they had just heard J.D. Vance is going to vote for a national abortion ban, he's coming for your freedom, he's coming for your Social Security and Medicare, he is a MAGA extremist, we probably could have won that race.
Tom, let me ask Rachel.
Sure.
I know you said in your book, and we know this, that in Australia, you are required to vote in Australia.
Right.
Now,
because
of that, do you think the electorate is more in tune with what's going on? It's about the same as here. It's just it's a day off. They vote on Saturday. Is that right? I thought I read that.
I can't say that I'm an expert in like mass public opinion and behavior in Australia. It's just one of a few. A lot of the countries are compulsory voting. I would assume so, though. I would assume that they're not civically educated, that they have absolutely no responsibility to vote, right? But I talk about, like, it's not just that because you're going to get a fine if you don't vote that these compulsory systems have such high participation. It's that they're institutionally designed. The citizens who are required by law to vote are going to be able to easily vote. Do you see what I'm saying? So, like, there is a day off. It is... you know, whatever. It's set up like your boss knows that you're going to go vote, right?
Well,
that's totally different.
I only want to interrupt you because in your book, I had read that in the last, maybe 2022, Oregon and Colorado were between 60% and 70% the voting numbers compared to Georgia, Florida, a few others were Texas was in the mid 40s. So with that being said, it's because you said it was much easier to vote in those states. So if it's much easier to vote, people who might be voting they're making a conscious choice to vote. So I think the results of the election would probably be more representative of the people who live in that state. Would you agree with that or not?
I mean, I would say this, like, we, you know, if we get through this Democratic emergency, then one of the things we need to be doing is Democratic reform. And, you know, one of those things might be compulsory voting, an institutionalized day off, vote by mail, institutionalized. But what we would have to do is have federal oversight of elections. Right now, the, you know, jurisprudence tradition is to, you know, let the state and local governments handle that. And that's why we have so much variation. But, you know, it is something that we should fix.
Interestingly enough, we have a second guest, and we're going to be talking about books that have been banned in, Manatee County here. I know you probably have some thoughts on that relating to the Republicans and Ron DeSantis. And, you know, it's going to be better for the children to ban.
Taking away our freedoms. Taking away our freedoms to read.
It's but Florida is a free state because, you know, there's a contradiction there, right, Rachel?
It's not an accidental contradiction. I mean, I've been studying the Nazis now for 3 years, right? I mean, they wrap themselves in very similar rhetoric, right? Because it's about, like, flipping the world into an upside down world, right? Where what's immoral becomes moral. Right. And that's exactly what they're doing, like, with their rhetoric. And you know, it's about when you're denying kids access to knowledge, but you're protecting them. Right. It's all about how they're framing stuff. It's very disturbing, obviously. You know, I'm doing a project called Project 1933 that started on January 30th with Hitler's inauguration as chancellor. And then we'll take people through the, you know, 6 months, basically, as Nazis consolidated power and became a dictatorship. And it happens very quickly. It happens through very particular steps that are absolutely replicable here, despite differences, significant differences, especially in institutional durability and stability between the Weimar Republic in the 1930s and us. But there are still many, many things that are very similar, and I'll be laying those out. And book burning is definitely on that list.
Will that be in a new book or a lecture or what?
That series I'm putting out on social media, on Twitter, so people can follow me on at Rachel Bitticoffer if they want to follow that.
I guess I better do that. I'm not on Twitter, but I will join it just for you.
There you go. You're really missing things if you're not following me on Twitter.
So. All right.
Before we sign off, let's plug Rachel's book again, Tom.
Yeah, it's Rachel Bitticoffer. Her new book is called Hit 'Em Where It Hurts. How to Save Democracy, that's key, by Beating Republicans at Their Own Game. And you can buy it now in bookstores. It just came out about a week ago. Rachel Bitticoffer, thank you so much for what you do and for what you continue to do. Thank you for being on our show. We're a little humble, low-power station in Sarasota, but we help you spread the word, and we appreciate it.
Hey, that's great. And your audience can help save democracy. So get the book and figure out how to save democracy together.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Rachel.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
See you later.
Bye.
Bob, you have the next guest.
Well, we're listening to the Peace and Justice Report right here on your own community radio station, WSLR 96.5 LPFM, WSLR.org on the internet. And yes, we have another interesting guest ready to join us, Tom. And let me let you know who it is. Her name is Marie Maspera. I might have that. She'll give us the correct pronunciation of that. But she's one of the organizers of Read on Manatee. It's a grassroots organization opposed to banning books in public school libraries. At least 76 titles have been removed from school shelves since August 2022, yet no challenges have been considered by the school board. So, Marie, thank you for being on, and you can correct my pronunciation of your last name by all means.
You're very welcome, and you did quite well. It's Masferer if you're using the English version, or Masferer. My husband's family fled Cuba for the same reasons that we're fighting book bans. So, journalists and librarians are the first to go to jail in a dictatorship, and we're finding out why. Just to tag off of what Rachel said, my students, I actually, when this started almost 3 years ago now, I posted the ALA's Library Bill of Rights, and you can see that in Manatee County Libraries. I love that they've posted it there. And I signed it before I posted it in my library here. I'm actually in my school library here in Hillsboro. I posted it as a promise, and I told the students, this is my promise to you. And I showed them the original copyright on the Library Bill of Rights from ALA. It's 1939. Wow. And my students, all of 10 years old, 9 and 10 years old, knew exactly what was happening in 1939. I said, well, why would the ALA write this? So our students are aware, our kids are listening, our kids are watching. And that's one reason that I started Read on Manatee and that I'm fighting. In Manatee County, the biggest problem are what we call shadow bans. Shadow bans are where librarians or principals or even school administrators decide to pull books without any documentation. And that's why I'm a little late to the game. I was fighting this at the state level. I'm on the Florida Association for Media and Education's board. I'm a board representative, but I was also chair of their legislative committee. So we were going to Tallahassee when 1069 and Senate Bill 7 were being written. And that's another reason, is I know what's in the law and I know what's not in the law. And what we're doing is we're using the words of the law. There might be a bad law that, in our opinion. However, we're using the words of the legislation to fight for parents' rights. And that's number one. Just because you disagree with a book does not mean you have a right to deny another parent the right. And that's the other thing, as far as rhetoric, parents have always had the final say. I've even had a parent to say, I don't want my child checking out any books from your library. I will be here to check them out. And that's fine. That's always been their prerogative. And so they've always had that power. But now there are parents of communities that are being eliminated, just completely wiped out. And in Manatee County, we actually have librarians who are violating students' and parents' civil rights. And that's why we are working on filing with the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education. I worked with the administration, and I do believe Dr. Weisong and Derek Jensen in the district office are trying, but we have several board members that are okay with pulling any and every books, and they're okay with telling people there's pornography in our libraries. Make no mistake, there is no pornography in a school library. Is there sexual content? Yes, but it is age appropriate, and there are also sex education books are being pulled. I mean, for goodness sakes, we've had dictionaries pulled in our state. So that's why I started the group, because my library, when I worked in Manatee County, someone sent me pictures. I'm the one who stood up in a school board meeting saying that my kids were crying. When we cover classroom libraries in Manatee County, students at my old middle school, I received emails from parents that they were pleading with the principal not to cover up their books. And those are my kids. Those are the ones I taught are no longer there. Some of the kids I taught are now out in the workforce. They've graduated from college already. That's how long it's been. But I'm very proud of that school. And Ardan Nolan Middle School holds the name of someone in Manatee County who worked his entire life for children. And his legacy lives on in that school. And so that's why I took this on, because the librarians were lied to about the law. Many of them were unaware.
Maybe I can interrupt you. I'd like to have the listeners be fully aware of how that legislation reads. So if you could, put it in a nutshell, what that legislation says.
Okay. HB 1069 is better known in the vernacular as Don't Say Gay. It specifically applied to instruction in LGBTQ issues in grades K-3. Then it was expanded the following year in K-12. However, the Department of Education actually went to court. It's a case from Lake County over a book called And Tango Makes Three, where two male penguins, it's a true story of two male penguins raising a chick. They actually said HB 1069 does not apply to libraries. It does not apply to self-selected materials, because they cannot say that in the law. And that's why we're using that law, because that is a violation of civil rights. So you can't instruct on those issues in the state of Florida, but children can select those materials. But in Manatee County, librarians were threatened by the former superintendent, saying they would be charged with a third degree felony if any book contained sexual content or LGBTQ, even an LGBTQ character. And they still believe that, because they have not read the text of the law and they've not kept up with what's there. So the biggest problem in Manatee County is there's not a certified media specialist at the district level that's fighting to keep the books on the shelf. Also, Senate Bill 7 is very similar, but they are written, both bills were written very vaguely for the purpose of gaslighting and causing the confusion you see today. For example, of what's been pulled, and you've heard all of the stories of what's pulled around the state, here in Hillsborough County, we've had one book removed, one. And our district policy is, if you challenge a book all the way to the school board and the school board votes to remove that book, it's only removed from one school. And keep in mind, in Hillsborough County, there are 248 schools. See why we wrote the policy the way we did?
Very
and
interesting.
In Manatee County, that used to be the policy. But right when the bills were being written in 2021, there was a district leader in Manatee County who got rid of the policy, the district policy, and basically made it so that a district committee could decide what was chosen. So I encourage your listeners to actually read the text of the bill, because it is written vaguely, but it still includes, just like the most recent legislation, the updates to 1069 and Senate Bill 7 allows for parents to challenge if you do not agree with a district decision. Now, they wrote it for people who want the books off the shelf, and like Hillsborough County does not pull the book off the shelf, you can take it to a special magistrate and the district has to pay for the court cost. But in Manatee County, that's one thing we're asking for. There is no recourse for parents. And since there's no documentation with the shadow bans, there is no way. Let's say a parent sees that there's a book that's been pulled off their child's shelf and they do disagree with it. There's no way for them to challenge that, because in Manatee County, the only people who can challenge pulling the book from the shelf or keeping a book are those who originated the challenge. So parents first find out about it when it appears on a SAC meeting, the School Accountability Committee reports in Manatee County, or they see it on a district ban list. They don't have any ability to get it back on the shelf or even to get it off the shelf if they did not originate the complaint. So it immediately goes to a special magistrate, which would cost the school district money right off the bat, whereas they could avoid the special magistrate if they just put a process in place. But they are working on that. The school board has said when this legislative session is over, they're going to come back and revisit the policy, because they know it does not meet state statute as it stands. And that's why Mary Foreman voted against it. She wanted a policy that met state law. Right now, the instructional materials policy in Manatee County does not meet the criteria of state law. It doesn't. It might be a bad law, but we're still not meeting it. So
I think I saw on the internet last night that Escambia County, they have 2,000 books taken away from the, was it from the library or from the schools? Wait, what? It was 2,000.
It's the schools. It's schools. And Escambia even lost one of the best media specialists I've ever known. She was on the FAME board, but she left the state. What she left behind were packages and packages of documents to defend books. So if there's anyone who needs to defend a book in their county, or they'd like to speak at the school board meetings in their counties all over the state of Florida, join the Florida Freedom to Read Project. All the information we have in the public records request that we've been able to get our hands on records, it is all because of the work of the Florida Freedom to Read Project. And they have the tools you need. They have letters, they have templates, they have how you can defend the bill. They actually have, I would encourage your listeners to go to their website, because they actually have what lies are told about the bills that are there and the truth about the bills. I said that they were very classy, because I would have used the top 10 lies you hear at a school board meeting. But they actually lay out the law very well, and they give you the tools they need to defend books that are very important for our kids.
Florida to Read Project.
Florida Freedom to Read Project. You can find them on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and they have a fantastic website.
Their web address is fftrp.org, which stands for FloridaFreedomToRead.org.
And what we're trying to do right now is encourage people to contact their representatives, because there is a bill. I'm going to see if I can find the number, because I had it up. It's the Freedom to Learn Act that has been introduced in the Florida House. So if you look up the Freedom to Learn, and there's also a Freedom to Read Act that was it's a bipartisan bill that was introduced in the House last year. We actually recognize the writers of the U.S. representatives who wrote that bill. And so those two things we've been trying to help with too. So there is pushback happening. It's just little by little and very incrementally. I'd also encourage your listeners, and if there's an investigative reporter out there, look up Bruce Friedman in Clay County Schools. His group is called No Left Turn in Education. He moved here in 2020 from New York because, you know, the free state of Florida. But he's even challenged the rainbow fish. And my kids understand that. He didn't read the book. The rainbow fish is about sharing and kindness. But he wanted it banned because it has a rainbow. Anything with a rainbow and a unicorn. It's yes. So, and his most recent challenge is the book Wonder. If you've not read Wonder, it's the first book by R.J. Palacios. It was made into a movie. And it's all about kindness. It's treating each other with kindness. And his challenge is a kindergartner shouldn't read it. Well, kindergartners can't read it. I mean, their parents could choose to read it to them. But, I mean, it's a novel. It's a novel meant for grades three through five.
I was at an event at Fogartyville like 6 months ago, I think it was. It was a ban the books event. And they had so many books that were banned at the event at tables. And I got a few books, but one was Jackie Robinson. You know, I asked, was this banned in Sarasota? No, but it's been banned in other counties. And Cesar Chavez, and, you know, two historic figures, you know, who had a major impact on society, and we know about them. So I never really did find out why would they ban those books, Jackie Robinson and Cesar Chavez.
Well, and those were banned because, and that's part of Senate Bill 7 includes the SEL, social emotional learning books, and CRT that we're not allowed. The first time I heard CRT, it was on a talking point. I've 27 years in public education. I've never heard the word CRT. It doesn't exist. And SEL, the social emotional learning, we pushed those books big because of COVID, because we worried about our children's mental health during that time. So they would socialize with each other when they returned to school. So parents heard a lot of that on the Zooms during COVID because we wanted to make sure that they were checking in with their mental health and also connecting with people, even if it was just visually or through the internet. So that's why those two things came up. But make no mistake, this entire push is an attack on public education. In the state of Florida, they want to get rid of public schools, and they want to leave behind people who do not have transportation, who do not have their own access to books, and that they don't have enough money. They're struggling for survival, and they want their stories eliminated. We are undergoing a renaissance in children's literature. 15, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, I dreamed of the books that sit on my shelf right now. And that's what I told my mother. My mother's like, Marie, just leave it alone. You don't need to take this on. And I said, this is a woman who fought for 40 years for children. And I said, Mama, they're not banning any books. They're banning the best books. And these are the books and the stories our children need. And I actually had a trans student at my school who said, what about the books? And that's why, to me, this is a civil rights fight of my life, because I know, and children have told me, that books have saved their lives. The stories that are told tell them they're not alone. I myself have recently found myself in a book, and I just cried tears because I wish I'd had that book when I was 11, 12, 13. Starfish by Lisa Phipps is an incredible book with children who suffer with body issues or self-esteem, or even children who need to understand that. And that's the other thing, is books open windows on other people's experiences. I myself, straight white old lady, my whole perspective, raised in Virginia, my whole perspective on the Civil War was changed by the book Stamped by Ibram Kendi. I did it with some old white librarians out of Palm Beach. We did that during COVID, and we all kind of laughed about that. We were wrong color, wrong place, wrong perspective. But it is eye-opening, and I learned the difference between being not racist and anti-racist. So your listeners, you would do yourself a world of good and America the good if you read the adult version or even the kid version. They even have one for grades 3 through 5. And I love it. My kids come in and say, where are your banned books, Miss M? Yeah. And that's one of them. They love that book because it's true history. It's real history.
What's the name of that book again?
It's stamped from the beginning. There's actually a Netflix movie of it. I think it actually won an Emmy. But I highly recommend the book, Stamped by Ibram, I-B-R-A-M, Kendi, K-E-N-D-I.
Oh, yes. I recognize his name. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Excellent book. But I can guarantee you the next step is they're going to say our reading scores, our public schools are failing because our reading scores tanked. Well, you think it might be because kids are not interested in reading. But I will say this, the new adopted text, the textbooks that we have Florida best standards, they changed the standards again. When the books arrive, the supplementals to the reading materials, it's the most woke collection ever. The best books I've ever seen.
Oh, that's great. Great.
Maybe I shouldn't put that out in the public, but our children are reading them in the classroom. And I don't know that they knew what they were doing when they put that set up for adoption, but we love our reading adoption this year.
Right. Well, you have a good commute every day up to Hillsboro.
I do. But one reason I did it is I was being paid the same amount of money for 10 straight years in Manatee County. They got rid of their steps. So I'm paid almost $10,000 more here in Hillsboro County. I am completely supported by my parents. When the book banners came to my, they actually sent a van with the one book that we've removed here in Hillsboro. They sent it to my parking lot out here. My PTA was in my doorway, just like stair steps, like the Three Musketeers. What are we going to do? Who do we call? And so plus I have an IB school. This is International Baccalaureate. So all my SEL books, they're not SEL. They're my IB books and I need them. My IB profile traits and social action is what we teach because IB was created to create world peace. And so the books I have in my library, I will defend them because they support every IB principle that we teach in our school.
Oh, well.
But I'm very lucky to be here. I really am.
Yeah. Well, tell the listeners, we only have a couple minutes left, more how they can get in touch with Read on Manatee. And okay. I know you have meetings periodically.
Well, I had an informational meeting, and we'll probably be doing that again, maybe spring break or the summertime. But find us on Facebook. It's Read on Manatee. And then our email address is readonmanatee@gmail.com. The Read on Manatee is private. For reasons, if you are a journalist or you're a school board member, sorry, you're not in. Yeah. However, if journalists can email me, then I respond. And what we really ask is support. What we're really looking for right now is support of our school librarians. Like for Valentine's Day, our members are actually taking a little card, letters, plants or a rose to our local schools to say thank you, because the librarians do feel put upon and they're very scared right now. They've had 4 years of sheer terror in Manatee County. So we're actually going out and supporting them, shaking their hands and saying we're there for you. Please show up at every school board meeting. We've seen in county commission and city council meetings, if we show up, we want to show them there are more of us who want the books on the shelves than there are out there to ban them. And there are. Our numbers show that. Florida Freedom to Read Project, fewer than 10% have asked for their children not to have full access to libraries across the state of Florida. So there are more of us, but we've got to show up. We've got to speak out. And that's really what I want to do is to organize people. And at every evening meeting, we're going to have a read-in before every evening meeting, just because most of us work. So just quietly read our favorite books and then make a public comment at each school board meeting. So if you show up for that, you'll see me there. And if you can attend workshops or daytime meetings, we're just having people show up and take notes. So I'd love it if your listeners would join us in that fight.
Well, thank you so much, Marie. We really appreciate it. You've given us an education. Alvaro.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you have a question, Alvaro?
Yes, I do have a question, or I have a comment.
I can't hear Alvaro.
I can't hear you, Alvaro.
Okay. Unfortunately, it begins this question like a minute before we're signing off, so I'm afraid you won't be able to answer whatever question that might be, Marie.
But stick around for a second. Stick around.
Yes, you're right. Okay. You're right. I always wait till the last minute.
Yeah. Hold on.
That's okay. Go ahead,
Alvaro. Okay. Well,
my comment is very short. Yeah, my comment is very short. And that is, I want to say a wonderful program today. Thank you for your presentation. I do want to speak in favor of Cuba, which was, I think, derated at the beginning. And I want to tell you that in 60 years that I've been in this country, I have not heard one single program in Spanish TV or radio that have...